Okay, it's not a sarcastic thank you, it's a real one.
The Hess meeting is called to order. Let the record show that it is 3:34 on April 26, 2:05, and let the record reflect that Representative Anderson, Representative Gardner, and Representative Cisna, and myself, Wilson, are present. And
I could be in big trouble.
And my helpers over here, my Hess Committee aide is Kathy Hope Erickson, my secretary is Ellen Nodder, and moderator is from the LIO is Dawn Finley Groves. So we appreciate that they're all here helping us make sure things run smoothly. So what I'm going to do is quickly, we have someone that's been waiting online for 36 minutes. And so let's open it up for the confirmation hearings for the University of Alaska Board of Regents, Mr. Jacob Gondek. And are you online? Are you there?
Try again.
We really can't hear you, so... it's getting better.
Well, I am here, Chairman. I can hear you.
Okay, you can hear us fine?
Yes.
Okay, would you just go ahead and we have your resume and the committee attached, and what we would like you to do is just tell us why you feel you would qualify for appointment to the Board of Regents. Yes.
Okay. I'd first off like to thank you for the opportunity of speaking with you today. Over the past couple of years, I've had leadership opportunities at UAA. I was the former student body president, as you guys can see in the resume there. And I'm also a member of the ANSTEP program, where I get to work with some of the youngest and brightest Alaskans in the state. The acronym for ANSTEP is Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. An excellent opportunity for myself to work with these with the Alaska Natives, and I've learned a lot from them, and I feel I have a chance now to represent the state well with my previous experience as the former student body president and former Residential Housing Association president, at which point we had a chance for a national award for most improved RHA committee.
And I'm also the current student ombudsman at UAA, and I sat last year on the Chancellor Search Committee, in which I had the opportunity, a great opportunity to sit with some excellent board members and experience that process as well. So, okay. I was wondering, actually, if there's any questions from the representatives or from yourself, Chairman.
Well, your community and public service list here is impressive, and I think Representative Gardner has a question for you.
Thank you. Congratulations, Jacob. I think that you have a very impressive resume and clearly a lot of interest in public service. What I'd like to know is, what would you like to see the UA Board of Regents accomplish in the next few years?
Well, I think keeping in mind the master plans that have been going on at each campus is a key factor. For example, the Mat-Su campus, I know they're currently working on their master plan out there, and I would like to keep that in mind, as well as I know there's been master planning committees going on throughout most of the state. I think keeping it, unfortunately, you know, it's hard as a student to look at every single university coming from one university, but I would like to look at the main master plans and understand that those master plans are coming from the committees that represent that university and follow along with that master plan. So I would say the master plans would probably be my key factor with the board.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Jacob, one, congratulations. Two, I think you know that that I have real concerns about, and I'm very, I think it's understandable that I'd be especially interested in the UAA campus. How all of the campuses work together is extremely important, and each campus has strengths that that have a synergistic effect on the other campuses. The UA campus is unique in that it is within a larger campus of health facilities, and I know there's a real considerable concern not only about the science facility at UAA, but also looking at sustainability in the community, making sure that the jobs that are available in that rich health employment center are filled by UA graduates getting appropriate degrees. And wanted to know if you have any thoughts on that issue and how, thinking in terms of the larger system, but the richness of the UA campus setting, how you can work on that as well.
Well, thank you again for welcoming me to the committee. Representative Cisna, as far as the science laboratory goes and the integrated science building, I think that's going to be an excellent building when it does come here in the near future. As far as keeping the young students involved, highly active within the community, I think that's one of the key factors that the chancellor, one of the key components that the chancellor is working on currently. And I believe with the young mayor, and he does an excellent job working, having the chance for students to speak with him, and at the same time allowing students to have those opportunities out there to work with Providence Hospital, which is right across the street from UAA, and some of the other smaller hospitals as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gardner has another question.
Yeah, I have another question. A growing number of Alaskan students are staying in state for college, and some of the credit goes to the Scholars Program, which I think is absolutely, you know, a wonderful idea. Do you have ideas for what else we can do to encourage Alaskan students to stay here, and also students who graduate here to help them stay in Alaska?
Well, for a personal experience, the expansion of the engineering program at UAA, I think, is a huge boost for the economy. Engineering is in demand in the state, and currently we don't supply enough engineers for that, so I think that's a key factor, and they're on the right way for that. I think the Scholars Program is doing its job. Unfortunately, with tuition increasing, the scholarships are still the same prices. Therefore, the students are paying a little bit out of their pocket, but I still think it's an excellent opportunity, and most of my friends currently at the university are on that Scholars Program. Mm-hmm. As far as other programs that we could pursue for that area, I think you definitely are fighting an uphill battle, considering it's most state universities are looked down upon by the local high schoolers. But I think it's key that we get out there and we pass the word along that it is a growing community and it's doing an excellent job, and the age has been dropping, whereas the average student age, I believe, is now below 25. And I think that's key for high school students to get out there and realize that it is a younger crowd, and it is a crowd that has opportunities to get out there and work in the field while at the same time going to college, where at other universities you don't have that opportunity.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jacob.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Jay, Jacob. And do I hear a motion?
Trying to remember the exact form, Madam Chair. I believe it is the HESC committee has considered the candidacy of Jacob Gondek, and I move
send the
we
forward the resolution.
Yeah.
We forward the candidate for consideration?
To a joint session.
To a joint session. To a joint session. Exactly.
Okay. Having heard no, and I'm kind of hesitating because I'm hoping Tom gets back here so that we have enough people. So what I'm going to do is take a brief at ease, because as soon as Tom can get back in here so that we can.
I don't know the rules. Can you open a second bill prior to closing down the first one?
I don't know. Is he coming? Yep. Okay.
I believe he has to.
Jacob, this is the end of session right now, and we have lots of bills going on. Even the people on the committees have other committees that are meeting at the same time and have bills of their own that are in other committees, sometimes even in the Senate. And so it's very difficult for us to keep a quorum. So one of the representatives have left to vote in another committee, and we're waiting for him to come back so he can vote in this committee.
Madam Chair, I believe that for him to vote, he has to be present when the motion is made, and so I'm going to withdraw my motion.
And that's fine. I accept that withdrawal.
Right.
And here, I've got it for you.
Thank you.
All right.
Well, you're going to sound brilliant now.
If I can read.
Oh, my ass.
Wordies.
Yeah, there you go.
Do I hear a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move that the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee has reviewed the qualifications of Jacob Gondek, the governor's appointee to the University of Alaska's Board of Regents, and I recommend that his name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration.
Okay. Hearing no objections, so moved. So congratulations, Jacob.
Yep, 3 minutes.
And we will pass this on to the next, to the joint session. There will be, the House and Senate will meet, and then there will be a vote taken. So thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for your time.
I have
Alrighty.
To for the vote. For the
next, you can go back now. If you need
I'll wait. If you can go quick, I'm supportive of all these bills.
There's going to be some public testimony, so if you want
to. Actually, the next one is going to be...
Representative Gatto's.
Yep.
House Joint Resolution 20. And yours is next after that. Okay.
In my book, it's
HCR 11 is so easy if you want to do that.
So
I support it. It's the Parents Day resolution.
Do you think you could do it real
Yes, I can do it real
Carl,
quick.
Just 2 minutes, and then I'll come back for yours because we're almost done. Oh,
so, we are going to do House Joint Resolution 11. Carl, thank you so graciously for being
Carl,
willing
I'll
to do that.
Carl, I'll be back in 5 minutes.
And we'll get back to Carl. And Representative Sisna, would you like to present your resolution?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Sharon Sisna, District 22 representative. And I am bringing before you House Concurrent Resolution Number 11. And what House Concurrent Resolution Number 11 does is after explaining and celebrating how important parents are to the state, to us as individuals, it resolves that July 24th, 2005 be proclaimed as Parents' Day. And I need not tell you about, especially this committee of all committees, the importance of parents. And in both in our sponsor statement, which again I think you have before you, and I certainly don't need to read it, but I think you know how important parents are in so many different ways. I should also tell you, and I don't know if Eugene Harnett is online and was going to say anything about this resolution. Do you know?
I would say through the chair, if Eugene is online, since he's employed by me and I have to go to this other committee, I'm going to ask him to be very brief.
Yeah,
I know he's passionate about it, but he knows if we can get it out of the committee, there's no need to talk about it.
And some another person on this committee mentioned to me just a minute ago, they said, well, why Parents' Day? Why we have Father's Day, we have Mother's Day? And there's a really important reason for that. And the important reason for that is Parents' Day is a public celebration. It's not
it's not something you do within your own family. It's what you do with your community. And in the community of Alaska, there's been a group that has been in place now for a number of years that takes nominations from throughout the state and then gets faith-based and community-based group together that have some expertise in making selections and select a parent of the year, which then goes back to a national, celebration. And Eugene Harnett can tell you a lot more about that. But it is something for us to celebrate how important families are. And in fact, and parents especially, I don't think we do it enough. So I think, Madam Chair, if Eugene Harnett wanted to say something, I think that would fill out all the information that probably you need.
Eugene, if you're online, do you have some testimony for us?
Yes, I do. Thank you. For the record, my name is Eugene Harnett, and I'm an aide to Representative Tom Anderson. I'm good to be here. And I'll be short. But what I also wear another hat, and I have worn this other hat for the past 10 years, and that is I serve as chairman of the Alaska Parents Day Committee, which Representative Sisna referred to. This is our 11th year. Parents Day Committee has been sponsoring public celebrations of Parents Day in Anchorage, and we have a big outdoor barbecue. The mayor comes, governor comes, public officials come, members of the legislature. Representative Sisna, she has supported it and participated in it for the last several years. So in each year, our committee chooses Alaska Parents of the Year, and we also choose awardees for excellence in parenting. And, of course, we honor all those parents that are nominated. We give them a congressional certificate signed by our Congressman Don Young. So it's becoming bigger and bigger as a public event each year, which is one reason why I think this resolution is so pertinent. First of all, I want to especially thank Representative Sisna for introducing this resolution and also for Representative Anderson for letting me work on it and those who have signed it as co-sponsors. Thank you very much. This really tells that the legislature of Alaska really recognizes the role parents play in the public life and ultimately in developing public policy. I believe parents play a big role because they inculcate the values that we as adults live by. And parents operate behind the scenes, unnoticed, except when something bad usually happens. But this is an opportunity to say, no, we recognize parents all the time, fundamentally, and it's important to note that. This is a holiday much like Mother's Day and Father's Day, but it is more. As Representative Sisna alluded to, Parents Day is not just the time to celebrate, but also to make a statement that underscores the vital role parents play in the lives of our children and really in the stability of our society. So this holiday, Parents Day, was originally established by Congress in 1994 as a recurring holiday. I remember when it was first discussed, I walked into Don Young's office here in Anchorage, and his secretary, I think it was Bobby, she said, oh no, they're not making any more new holidays. Well, this holiday did get passed unanimously by Congress and signed by the president, and it was bipartisan. I think that's one of the things that has struck me over the years, that honoring parents is not a political issue. This is really refreshing. And I'm so glad that the state of Alaska is at this time officially recognizing this with a resolution. We've had proclamations from the governor every year, but this is really better from the legislature, and I understand it's only for this year. Maybe in the future we could certainly like to see it established as a permanent holiday, but thank you again for doing this to honor Parents Day in Alaska. I think it's a well-placed effort. Thank you, Chairman.
Madam Chairman. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. He brought up a question that I actually was going to ask the sponsor, and if I can be really quick, the whereas talks about the fourth Sunday in July of each year, but this resolution refers only to July 24th of this year. Is that correct? That's your intention to do it this year only?
That is our intention, and
otherwise it would be a statutory change.
Okay. All right. I have no objection to that. I just wanted to know. Well, in that case, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House Concurrent Resolution Number 11.
Okay. Hearing no objections, so it has been moved. So thank you.
And I'll be right back.
And, you know, come forward, please. While Representative Gatto is coming forward, I just do want to make the comment that I think it really is important that we somehow recognize parents because, you know, there's a lot of single-parent families, and it's not easy to raise children in society nowadays, and we really need to give them credit for whether there's a single parent or there's two. That's not an easy job. So we now have before us House Concurrent Resolution 11. 20. Sorry. House Joint Resolution 20, Prostate Cancer Drugs, and Representative Carl Gatto will present his resolution.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I have a couple of people online that want to testify, and I'm going to be able to present a great deal of this, assuming it passes here when it reaches the floor, and I have some literature to hand out. And rather than be it repetitive, there are a lot of things in the whereases that certainly point out the importance of it, certainly for me. As many of you know, I'm a survivor myself, and so for the last 4 years I've been fairly well involved. I think of it more like a half-time job or certainly a third of a time job in the number of things, having spent several hours on the phone even today, as well as several days in the past week and several days in the previous week. It does take a lot of time, and so I wanted to sponsor this resolution because of the rather complete absence of drugs that are available. Even though there are some things that can be used, I think someday we're going to establish the Museum of Medical Curiosities. And in that museum, we're going to have things like chemo, and we're going to have things like masked pants, and we're going to have some things that people will simply marvel at, and will really enjoy a trip to the museum when we have something that is the dream that says, you give about a unit of blood, they take it and they add some sort of a magic virus to it, which injects the proper DNA, which identifies the cancer. They put it back in you. It multiplies, hunts down the cancer cells, and it's over. And that is about 50 years away. Meanwhile, it's going to be real hard to get 50 years out of this. So, we're more interested in kind of identifying and managing cancer. That's the most we can do is manage it. But management tools are in rare supply. There is not a single drug that I'm aware of that's used in prostate cancer, but there is one that has come up recently. At the University of Michigan, Dr. Moyad, who has an endowed chair there, has done some research on this. I talked to some other doctors in Los Angeles about this. And what we'd like to do is to simply encourage the feds to make drugs available. Even though we know they work, and when someone is in the last few moments of life, they seem to get some reprieve. We'd like to be able to see if it's possible to get some of these drugs online earlier. And as I said, I don't intend to talk a great deal about this because the whereases and the whereases and the whereases that go on and on simply tell you that, you know, five people a day in this state will contact cancer. And 25 are going to die every year just from prostate cancer. You know, when you look around, you say, which 25 is that? There may be some people that are destined to die, don't even know they have it, because when it shows up in a late stage, you don't have much time. So if we do have, I think, a couple people that want to testify, so I'm going to give up my time for them.
Madam Chair, I had a quick question.
Yeah, Representative Gardner.
I think your sponsor statement says 5 Alaskans a day are expected to die from prostate cancer. Did you mean just cancer in general, not prostate?
I think this
5 a day from cancer, and then one of your whereases.
This
says
is correct. 5 a day from cancer and 25 a year from prostate cancer in particular.
Okay. And one other quick question about prostate cancer. It's my understanding if men lived long enough, that prostate cancer, sort of like cataracts, everybody'd have it eventually, and it's sometimes just very, very slow growing and not really a problem, but sometimes it bursts. Is that?
Well, we do autopsies on people in car crashes, and all the men have it.
Yeah.
You know, you know, not been diagnosed, but if you slice it open and you do cell studies, it's there. Mm-hmm. It almost seems like teenagers probably have it, and very, mm-hmm. And it just takes forever to finally reach the stage. And as you get older and older, we see it finally show mm-hmm. up. But it's notorious for being absolutely guaranteed that if you get old enough, you will find it. And the treatment, of course, they vary from surgery to chemo to hormones to. I guess I'll do that on the floor tomorrow. There's a lot of treatments, and I'm familiar with a lot of details about them, and I really feel like I'd give a class by now. But I think we have Dale Snelson online. He heads up an organization called Us Two. And
okay. I'm shocked at the whereas on line 14. If I'm reading this right, it's $16.9 billion a year in lost productivity for employers.
Right.
Because of people that have prostate cancer. So, I mean, that's a huge amount.
Right. If I take a couple of days off to go somewhere for treatment, that's lost productivity.
Sure.
And if it's more than a couple of days, then it happens over and over and over again. It might happen a couple of days a month for many, many months. That's lost productivity.
Well, if the committee is ready, we will go to testimony. And off-site, we have a Dale Snelson from Us Two. Dale, can you...
Yes, good afternoon, madam. This is Dale Snelson. I live in Palmer, and I am the chapter leader and the regional director for Us Two for the state of Alaska. I didn't go to the doctor for 20 years, and that was the wrong thing. When I went, I was in very bad shape on a Gleason scale, and that's the correct measurement. It goes from 1 to 10. I was a 9 progressive. I opted to have a prostatectomy, which is removing the prostate. And because I was so far advanced, it had went into the lymph nodes, and that it metastasizes into the bones. And it's like Carl said, we don't really have the drugs to fight us. You know, breast cancer has been doing a great job for, 20 years or whatever it's been. And naturally, prostate cancer really hasn't caught on to the public yet. It's a deadly disease. It's the most solid tumor that the human body can conceive. And we was talking about age a while ago and the movement of it. It's not about 75% of it is very slow moving. For an example, you can be 65 years old, and 65% of the men will have it but not die from it. Now let's move up to 80 years old. 82% will have it and not die from it. But then on the flipping end, we have the 20%, and I'm in that 20% group. If I would have not had a prostatectomy a year ago, March, I would have been gone, dead by now. I've went through radiation. I'm on chemotherapy now. And, you know, there's just not much that they can do for us, although worldwide research and development on prostate cancer is just going like wildfire. And boy, how well accepted that is. You know, prostate cancer is a silent killer. It's not like breast cancer. And not only that, but I put on these health clinics and these seminars for Us Too, our prostate cancer awareness program. And it's amazing how many men don't even know what a prostate is. And it is very, very deadly. If you catch it early, like Carl said, you know, they can do the seeding process, and they can do a lot of things, and you will live, no problem. But when it comes down to like a case like mine, I would sure invite some new type of chemotherapy or something to just give me a little bit of quality and a good extension of life. But I can share with you, Alaskans they're really hard to penetrate as far as this prostate cancer. And we're really working on awareness programs now. We're going to start soliciting our blue magnetic ribbons. For when people see those, they'll say prostate. And that PSA, they don't go to the doctor, and you know, the wife is the one that takes these people to the doctor. You cut your finger, they put a black piece of tape on it, and next thing you know, they will go to the doctor once the wife tells them to go. So there's really a lot of things involved. Prostate cancer, Us Two has been 15 years. It's their 15th anniversary, And next month we will have, or actually, yes, in May, we will have our one-year anniversary here in Anchorage. They've been going at it for 8 years, and I do go into their meetings because...
Dale, if you can hear us all at once, we can't hear you. Okay. Do you know how old he is, Carl?
How old he is?
Yeah, I was going to ask him. Is he young?
60.
Is, are they coming back on?
He had his trip 2 years ago. He's 80. 81.
We'll wait. Do you have any other comments that you want until he comes back on, Carl?
No, I'd just as soon wrap up and...
This is for the next one.
Is Dr. Moyad listening?
Yes. Dr. Moyad, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Do you have any comments that you'd like to give us while we're kind of trying to connect up with Dale again?
Sure. Well, I didn't know I'd get an opportunity to speak, but I think this is great, and I appreciate everyone taking time to even address this matter, but I can tell you that I think I have a unique relationship with the people of Alaska in the sense that I just spoke in Juneau several weeks ago to the Men's Health Fair, and then I've been going to Anchorage for almost 10 years in a row speaking at their prostate group. And it was just in the past year that one of the leaders of their prostate group, the young man in his early 50s, just passed away from prostate cancer, and I talked to his wife. And the main issue was there were a number of potential promising treatments that I think this gentleman could have tried, but the problem was he couldn't get access to it. And so I had made a promise a while ago. I had made a promise to his wife that essentially we'd do all we can, that anything that looked promising, we would, instead of just doing research, we'd try to get involved in the process of trying to have people understand what's coming down the pipeline and how more attention should be paid to these things. Because prostate cancer is unique in the sense that if there's a promising drug in other areas such as breast cancer or colorectal cancer, even if the drug hasn't been approved yet, there's a program called EAP, Early Access Program, and some people know it as compassionate use, that if the benefit outweighs the risk and a patient has more advanced disease, they can get that drug even before it's approved, as has been the case in breast cancer and colorectal cancer. In prostate, that's not the case. And there are a lot of reasons why we could argue that people don't get that opportunity. So when a potential promising therapy comes along, as is the case in this case, and is coming up soon, not only we'd love to have Alaskans, but people around the world get access to it. And that's what we're hoping for, to bring more awareness and to allow more people access to these new targeted therapies, which we don't have one in prostate cancer. We have 9 approved. I believe it's 9 now. And we don't have one approved in prostate cancer. In other words, a therapy that could potentially help advance patients with a low rate of side effects. So in this case, the one product that we're talking about, one of the biggest side effects is not hair loss and nausea and vomiting. It's simply a runny nose, and there was a small percentage of patients that experienced headaches from it. So it's these younger patients, too, that we've been affected by not having access to these things. And I think the unfortunate part about prostate cancer is it sort of developed this reputation is that more people die with it than from it. And the problem with that line of thinking is that actually if you do autopsy studies of people in their 80s, 90s, and 100s, you see just as many people with breast cancers or thyroid cancers as you do with prostate cancers. And so it kind of, what happens in that case when we talk about that fact is it kind of sort of in a way belittles the fact that it's the second leading cause of cancer death in men, that about 30,000 men still continue to die. 28 to 30,000 men can still continue to die of prostate cancer in this country alone. So I was really here to listen in and to hope that attention be paid to this document, but I think that kind of summarizes the problem that we're dealing with. We don't have any sort of more benign therapies or targeted therapies in prostate cancer. We have a lot of older patients affected by this disease. We also now have a lot of younger patients affected by it. And getting good access to promising treatments is a real problem. In fact, I don't know of a cancer that has more of a problem than prostate when it comes to this issue. So I just thought I would throw my two cents in there concerning this. And I got to had a chance to talk to Representative Gatto when I was there in Juneau. It was a great visit. But at the one day we had free, we went over all this information. I think he was surprised in a sense, as much as most people are, in terms of all the problems that we have in this area and this cancer and the number of people that die from it. But a lot of these patients too are younger, and so I think that's just kind of a little summary of what's going on in my field.
Doctor, do you have any idea? I mean, is there any inkling of why the rate is increasing?
You know, the rate has gone up. Last year we saw a little bit of a stabilization of it, but what we're seeing is we're seeing a lot more patients diagnosed earlier with more aggressive tumors. And you know, the only thing that we've agreed on after 20, 25 years of more intensive research is we agree that aging is a risk factor. As we get older, that certainly is a risk factor. Well, can't do much about that. Family history, we're seeing more family history, so we're seeing more genetic risk. And race, we also go back and forth, can be a risk factor. But family history has become a fairly significant risk factor. Now, there's argument that from obesity to diet, a lot of lifestyle issues are affecting these rates. And I would tell you that I agree with that somewhat, because if you look at countries that have low rates of prostate cancer, when those groups move to the United States, within one generation, they essentially experience the same risk, or almost the same risk, as what we experience in the United States. So there's a migration component. And so a lot of people have used that to say that it's clearly maybe something in the environment, something about our diet, something about our lifestyle that's putting us at an increased risk. And I think that's certainly part of the reason. But I also think part of the problem is genetics. I just think, you know, we're seeing now, it's not unusual to see two generations or three generations of prostate cancer in some of these families that come to the clinic. But there are a lot of theories as to why, and there's probably a little bit of everything, but, you know, we're still seeing these numbers, and it's been very disappointing. I thought we'd be doing better at this point.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gardner has a question for you.
Thank you, Doctor. You talked about the fact that there isn't any, compassionate access
mm-hmm.
for prostate cancer drugs. Do you know why that should be different than for other kinds of drugs?
I think why we should get compassionate access, or why it's the case?
Why it's the case.
I think part of the reason it's the case is there hasn't, I think it's changing now, but there hasn't been this kind of passionate movement that we see, large-scale passionate movement that we see in the HIV or AIDS groups, and it's certainly not like we see in breast cancer. I mean, breast cancer leads the way. I mean, any promising drug that's coming to the FDA, I think you suddenly can see almost thousands of people or hundreds of people march in a moment on Washington. So there's that level of awareness and a level of immediacy with some of these other tumors that prostate cancer hasn't enjoyed, but I certainly see that changing. But why that transition's taking place, because I remember speaking to Betty Ford, who's from our state, when she was diagnosed with breast cancer. She said, you know, I do believe in my heart that, she said, when I was diagnosed with breast cancer in the early 70s, there was no real movement and there were no real educational material. And then suddenly, wow, look what's happened in 30 years. She said, you know, I know you get frustrated with prostate cancer sometimes, but I think you'll see that change. And I think we're seeing that change, but of course it's never as fast as you want it to be. So of all the years I've been doing this now, which is now my 18th year, I would have to say that 2005 and hopefully 2006 has been one of the more passionate years. I see more support groups, more people getting involved politically, more people getting involved in asking for more research dollars. So, but it's a slow movement. It's a slow transition.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's just good that we have people that are willing to step out and say, hey, you know, this has happened to me, so we need to really get a handle on this and see if we can do something. And I think maybe that's helping.
I'll tell you, I don't know if you can still hear me, but I can tell you the other interesting kind of coincidence is that I'm actually out in California right now and quite accidentally made this phone call at the right time, which I'm glad I did. But I was out here because my cousin had prostate surgery, had a radical prostatectomy a couple days ago. So we were taking care of him. And he's 56. And so this is now our second case of a young person with prostate cancer in our own family. So from the research that I do to my own family history to I look at what's happening to their cancers, I mean, you can see how you feel this sense of immediacy, like we need to do more. Maybe you know, we need to look in the mirror too. Maybe as researchers and doctors, we need to get more involved in the political process, not just only in the research process. And I think that's a part of the reason how I ended up meeting Representative Gatto and others in Alaska and discussing this matter.
Well, thank you for doing that. Representative Sisna has a question.
Thank you. Doctor, I am also, I don't know if it's an also, I'm a cancer veteran, I guess you could say, but mine is breast cancer, and the what I had heard was that the two cancers that were on the increase were prostate and breast cancers. And I have become aware through this resolution that we're not the same, in that there is a difference in terms of public maybe public compassion. I don't know if it is. I think it's maybe more of the strong male. Could that possibly be? But if in fact there is those two are on the increase, is it possibly the organs in our bodies that affect that, or what do you think it might be?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of similarities between breast and prostate in terms of genetics and in terms of how we treat it. One of the primary ways we treat breast cancer is to affect a woman's hormone levels to reduce the levels of estrogen in her body. And one of the primary ways we affect prostate cancer is to reduce the primary male hormone, or testosterone. So they're both hormonally driven cancers, and so they do share a lot of similarities. And I think that, you know, women for years now have been very strong and very passionate about going to the doctor, and early detection has become a very big issue, and funding has increased significantly. And I see a lot of great headway. In fact, there are some drugs on the breast cancer side we're really eager to try on the prostate side, because we think they might have effectiveness in both directions. But I can tell you that the number of cases is still staying about the same. The death rate from both the cancers has leveled off just a little bit in the past year or two, but it dropped by only about 1%. And so, you know, many of the issues that women deal with breast cancer are certainly some of the same issues we deal with prostate, except I think the one difference that maybe has affected drug development has been that the average age has been a few years higher for diagnosis for prostate than breast. And so I think breast cancer has this awareness of more of a younger person's disease, which I think has maybe has affected some of the attention. But I see what excites me about breast and prostate research is I see that as we make developments in prostate, we can potentially use some of these drugs in breast cancer and vice versa. I certainly don't see them mutually exclusive in terms of drug development. And that's what I'm very hopeful about.
Okay, thank you, Doctor. Are you ready? I do want to ask, Dale, did you have anything left that you wanted to add? I know you kind of got cut off in the middle and we lost connection, and you're back now?
Yes, I'm here. The one note that I wanted to say, which the doctor knows, 35-year-olds are now coming down with prostate cancer. Just like he mentioned, that one of the leaders in town there in Anchorage, he was 46 years old, and he passed away from prostate. So, you know, the age group has really moved down the level. A year ago, they were saying if you're 50, get checked. Now they're down to 35 for a baseline. And so the other thing, he's right on the money when it comes to generics. Us Two sends out hot sheets once a month, and these are research and development programs for prostate around the world. And it's just amazing what they're coming up with. But the age group and the generic effect is a real term. And the problem with us men, it's early detection, and it's a silent killer. You see, there's no symptoms. The symptom I had was it felt like my bladder was full all the time. Well, when the prostate gets infected, it enlarges, pushes up on the prostate, next thing you know, and then you're in trouble. you're in trouble at that point, which I was. But no, he's right on, and some of these, I wished I had some of those test medications to take now to maybe prolong or give me a better way of life. But, you know, until I said a year ago, prostate cancer and breast cancer must work together.
Okay, thank you very much, Dale. Representative Gatto, do you have any concluding remarks?
Just a short one. Mark, are you still there?
Yes.
We had talked about a very specific drug, Xynlay, and its effect, and then since then, in the last week, I'd come across another drug called Provenge.
Yes.
Familiar with the effects of that and its success?
Yep. Both. Provenge is a vaccine, and Provenge is given three times as a simple injection. And then, there's a long story of how it's done, but it's one of the sort of these benign treatments where the benefit clearly outweighs risk, and they've seen it impact survival. It may be one of the first vaccines that may actually allow cancer patients to live longer. And, if this goes through and this really works, I think the potential application of the same process being utilized in other cancers is amazing. And I think the other thing to keep in mind, though, is as we discover some of these new drugs to help patients with more advanced stages of the disease, I can tell you one of our first thoughts is to then dial back. What would happen if we used some of these more benign treatments earlier on? I mean, could we avoid some treatments or could we prevent the disease? And I think that's one of the most exciting things, that if you have a drug where one of the primary side effects is a little bit of irritation at the injection site, like with the vaccine, or with the pill, a little bit of a runny nose, and we use those earlier in younger individuals, can we slow the progression of the disease? I think the answer is going to be yes. And, it's just like if you look at breast cancer, the example of breast cancer came up. I mean, the primary drug used in breast cancer, tamoxifen, is also a drug now approved for the prevention of breast cancer. And so it's not just for one situation. It's these drugs have promised to be used throughout the whole spectrum. And there's where my excitement is. But also, you know, I mean, the process is very slow, and my frustration lies in the sense of how long it takes to actually come up to committee, how long it takes to vote on, how long it takes to get awareness up there. But I think that this situation is helping tremendously, and that's why, again, I can't say enough. I'm just appreciative that this has come up.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Do I hear a motion?
I'm going to make a motion. I move HCR 20 with individual recommendations, attached fiscal note, and an annual exam every year.
And, Doc, that will move this bill onto the House floor probably tomorrow.
Great. So that takes care of House Joint Resolution 20. Thank you, Representative Gatto. Thank you for being willing to bring it forward and bring it into the light more.
Thanks.
Okay, we have one bill left, and that is, now, which one are we?
14, House Bill 14. Is that the one we're correcting?
114.
114.
Yeah, okay, but on House, we were going to do House Bill 14, and what about, actually, I'm stumbling around here, and the reason I am is because when we decided last week that we were going to put things in 114, I got a letter from Legal Services, and they said that we couldn't do that because of the title, and we have to go ahead and put into we can't use that one because without it going back through and starting over. So what I've done is I've pulled the things that we have requested into a brand new bill, and it will be a House Hess Committee bill. And so I've pulled those and I think, Kathy, do you have them to hand out? Is it in their packet at all, the new bill? Did we get it back from Ledge Legal? So it hasn't come back yet. And so we do have it, and it will be, when we get it, we will have it read across, and then it will come to this committee. And I'm hoping that we'll at least be able to talk about it, discuss it before session, before we're done with session. So because of that, we cannot put it in this in House Bill 114, and so I went ahead and because I wanted to do, continue with the wishes of the committee, and we're going to go ahead and pull that and bring it in, introduce it in another bill.
Madam Chair, I had a quick question, though, for the record, pertaining to HB 114. Could I put that on the record?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. The language that we proposed in House Bill 114 required that HESS adopt the new emergency regulations that allows the personal aid, I guess it would allow the personal allowance for residents in assisted living homes, and it would tweak that as we discussed. And we felt the language was good. It sounds like because of what you've talked about, we'll have a new.
But we did go ahead and move last week that amendment was to be transferred on into 193, and we did that.
Okay. Well, no. I think Commissioner Gilbertson told the working group, I'm looking at my notes, that met last week on this, that the preference was getting the budget authorization to address the problem. Was it? I don't see John Bitney. Maybe I'm wrong. Well, let me just, my notes show here that this morning, I wasn't there, but Janet Clark presented the Senate Finance Committee, I think, with an $18 million supplemental budget. Is that right?
She did.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, good. I get a head shake. And the request for Medicaid under the Division of Senior and Disability Services. In fact, it was dated April 22nd, the same day we moved that bill, so there must have been some dialogue. I guess if they can answer it now, that would be great, or maybe later. But why can't HESS then amend their request for another $362,000? And I ask that because the backup presented last week by HESS said that the cost of HB 114, I know we don't have that before us, but they get my drift procedurally.
Sure.
Okay, we're going to have another bill. They understand what the point of the next bill is, whatever it's assigned. That would be $181,000 in general funds and then $181,000 in federal funds under Medicaid. And this would cover the amount of money the department has told us that they would need and it would cost. And Commissioner Gilbertson then can use the existing emergency regulation authority under statutes. And I don't know why they didn't do that or ask for that. There's some leveraging going on. Commissioner Gilbertson was supposed to meet with me. I made a mistake and couldn't meet with him at 10 o'clock yesterday. He didn't reschedule. He met with Representative McGuire. And she's not here, but I would assume she would concur that certainly the department and the division directors, they want their legislation for HESS, different ones this year, to move on. But we as the legislature, now it's again, I mentioned last week, I'm one of the ones that will admit it on record, it comes down to strategy. And we want to at least be able to make sure that will try to seek that. And I just wonder why that wasn't amended with that amount of money. Because the supplemental is being requested now. We know there's an assisted living problem. We've had the dialogue. Why didn't they tack on the amount, this $362,000? Could maybe someone respond to that?
Okay, and let's have a brief at ease, because I'm not sure we're talking the same thing, so let's have a brief.
Maybe we're not. Maybe I misunderstood. For your indulgence, let me speak. I recognize that we changed the commissioner's bill and amended it on Friday and passed that on, and you tried to use House Bill 114, which was essentially a dead bill in the HESS committee, as the vehicle for our assisted living fix. Ultimately, legal services, as you've testified, has stated, no, you can't do that because it was already heard in one committee and voted out. And so we're going to have a new vehicle, a new HESS bill, which you're going to have introduced this week.
And I've already pulled, they're working on it.
That's
and
right.
We're waiting for
and
it.
House Bill 114 is dead, so that assisted living bill I won't have a dialogue on yet because it's not appropriate. It's not before us, and that essentially that bill hasn't been notified through publication of this committee meeting today. However, on that issue, I've asked on the record about why when Commissioner Gilbertson stated on Friday, I see there's a problem. If we added to the supplemental, that would be the fix, but we have to determine how and if what effects that would make. I just wondered why that wasn't entertained this morning, and maybe if one of the division representatives could note on the record why, when I felt we had the chance to add the $362,000, it wasn't done this morning in Senate Finance.
And actually, before you answer that, I do have, because I thought he said we can't do it unless we have another more money put in the budget, right? He did say that. And then we were talking about ratcheting down another program so that we could use that money. So that's kind of...
Oh, that's fair. I mean, I just wanted
so
on the record.
That's where I thought the process was. And now if you want to go ahead
I won't debate you. I'm just listening.
We'll like to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Steve Ashmer. I'm the Director of the Division of Senior and Disability Services. And it's my understanding, I've not talked to Commissioner Gilbertson about this, but it is my understanding that the reason that it wasn't addressed in the supplemental budget this morning is because we've not had the opportunity to talk to OMB about this increase in the supplemental of the $283,000 or whatever the amount is. But we want to find the quickest mechanism to fix the problem. If it is this legislation, that's fine. If we can do it through the operating budget, I think that's what the commissioner wants to do. So whatever the most expedient method to fix this is the way we want to go with it also.
Okay, Representative Sisna.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, for the record, I'd also like to make a statement. I did receive a copy of the letter that I think Janet Clark gave to the Finance Committee today. Was it the Finance Committee that she made that presentation? It said in at the very beginning, the legislature has given us direction to. And it talked about cost containment and that kind of thing. And having served on the very committees that would give direction, what I know is that that direction usually is printed up and given to us, and we approve it or don't approve it, and it's usually pretty quick process, and this is a slow process. In this one, we had lots of people come in, and we've talked to lots of people, and we've spent time in committee talking about it. And it's probably a more thoughtful process, and it's the first time we've been able to do this since I think the awareness of just how bad the situation, both with the assisted living and the personal care attendants, has been. Because I don't think the legislature really understood that was growing exponentially out of control, and it was it is almost exponentially, and that awareness, there's a lot of little factors in there about that growth of that particular sector, because even though the growth has been dramatic, nonetheless you're talking about maybe, what is it, 4,000 people that are being affected by that piece. And so if you look at the difference between the PCA services and, for instance, nursing home, by comparison, it's still a small amount. And that part, I think, legislators need to understand. I mean, we hear from our constituents, and we need to understand this. And I think this is the first time we've really had a really good conversation as legislators with the department on this. And I wish that we could slow it down, because when I keep hearing from folks and I keep telling them I'm talking to the department, I want to know that the department's listening. So that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
And, you know, we have a lot of people online, but we really can't have testimony on this, really, because of the fact that we don't have a bill before us. And so, you know, we probably could take a few testimonies, but I think it would be better off just to wait until we've got the actual bill before us so that they can see what it is and they know what's in it.
But Madam Chair, could at least the committee ask while they're here?
Absolutely. Yeah, Representative Gardner, go ahead. Yeah.
Recognizing that the majority of this committee and maybe others support it, could the Department of Health and Social Services simply add the money necessary to cover the personal needs allowance for assisted living homes? I mean, does that have to be a bill to do it, or can you not just?
Through the chair, to Representative Gardner, if we can do that through the operating budget, we will attempt, through the supplemental will attempt to do that.
Well, Madam Chair, do we need a legislative fix if they actually have the authority? I mean, if they amended or supplemented the supplemental budget to get the additional funds, could it not just go through in that way?
Just because now's the time.
Representative Anderson?
You know, it's the next week or the window is gone.
Yeah, I mean, I know we're at a crucial timeline here.
But does it have to be a legislative? I mean, do we have to have a bill to make that happen if you understand the intent?
I can't answer that.
Well, and through the chair, I realize you have to you answer to the commissioner, but that's something at some point we'd like him back to answer because he's going to say, well, you find me the money. But, I mean, the supplemental, when you do a supplemental, there's no money for that. I mean, that by its very nature, a supplemental is defined as you have a budget of $100, hypothetically, and I'm sorry, I need a supplemental for an extra 10. So when you make your budget, the presumption is, okay, the legislature is suggesting and endorsing that we can afford 100, and a department comes back and says, hypothetically, we need 10 more dollars, so we're going above the budget. And obviously, as legislators and the policymakers, I concur with the question. If you could relay to him, if we're making a deal to pass their legislation, which we it seems like support, can't we add that now this week? And if you could relay to him that it's timely that he add that to the supplemental, which wasn't encapsulated in the original budget in the first place, hence its name supplemental.
Through the chair to Representative Anderson, I'll pass that on to the commissioner. And we just thought that if you, well, with 114, it would be another mechanism just in case, a fallback mechanism. So we'd have two different approaches at it, and whichever one materialized first, great.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. So, in effect, the answer to the question is you don't really need 114 in order to accomplish the goal. You just need to supplement the supplemental budget.
Through the chair, we need the money.
Right.
We need the appropriation.
So it's a question of having the appropriation, not the legislation necessarily.
Okay. That would be accurate.
For 1 year, though.
That for actually the supplementals for this fiscal year.
Yeah. That's it.
Any other questions? Because I'm, you know, I'm totally open to what needs to be on the record and what needs questions need to be asked and. Representative
Sisna,
Tom, thank
you. I have that expected look on my face. Madam Chair, I would assume that it would be very, very difficult at this point to get a piece of legislation through the legislature, correct?
Well, it depends on how many committees it's given.
Right.
I think our best bet is a supplemental or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I actually rolled some intent that from a Senate bill into that bill so that we had what you were concerned about plus some guidelines that the Senate put in for personal care attendants.
Mm-hmm.
And I so in case anybody's interested, I pulled that out of there and just rolled it in thinking that we could then massage it once it got to committee.
And Madam Chair, just one last question for me. So I remember your intent on Friday. Thank you. You asked that we remove or not try to amend the Commission's Department of Hess's bill, and that moved on. And then you, which we appreciated, you were gracious to help with this House Bill 114. Legal Services says no, wait, you have to pull it back. There has to be a new vehicle. So now that's delayed, not by your fault by any means, but Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. And now we have to have a bill introduced. I think Representative Sisna brings a very salient point. If you could commit to helping us work with the Speaker who assigns the committees that it only go to Hess and Finance, I think we've debated the issue enough. I don't know why it would need to go to a third committee. That would help.
Okay.
I know no guarantees, but at least commit to helping on that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the bill's going to – we let the other bill go in exchange kind of for this
right.
one.
Well, my concern is – that we really haven't had a real good discussion on that part of the bill yet. And, you know, I would be very willing to gavel out so that we could call, whenever I get it, that we could call, bring it up, you know. I'm willing to do whatever I can.
Okay, and then just one last response. When you say we have a lot of discussion on the assisted living we have because we had four subcommittee meetings. I don't know how much more. That's probably the most intensive bill.
Oh, I didn't mean that.
Oh. I mean the assisted living issue. Sure. Representative Sisna's issue was amended to the other legislation, which is headed to judiciary.
Okay. Yes, I'll
the new bill, yeah, that you're having coming. If you could help us work to make it assigned to only two committees, that would be appreciated.
Okay. Yeah, and I will try to do that. Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, what I would hope is that I personally am committing myself to spending some time this summer really looking into this issue in greater depth and trying to, since I'm getting a lot of context from my own community on these two issues, that it's come to my attention that I really do have to understand it better, and that I'm hoping that the committee as a whole would be willing to also partner with me in that exploration.
Yes, I mean, we'll do everything that we can to pull this together. Would you make copies of that so that everybody can have it? Any other comments? Okay, I will recess for the call of the chair. So, thank you, everyone. Good.